Tonight on Arena, prime suspect writer Linda LaPlante gives us the old and the new in her latest thriller, Buried, and a new book sketching and photographing the life of Nick Cave. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. In Buried, the latest book from prime suspect writer Linda LaPlante, a burnt cottage with a mysterious body and a fortune buried in its ashes could be the missing piece in the solving of a decades-old crime. The novel brings us into the world of DC Jack Warr, recently moved to London from Devon, and it also deals with his interactions with a female-led criminal gang that might just teach him a thing or two. And Linda LaPlante joins me now. I'll get to Jack Warr in a minute, Linda, but in fact, the book opens in 1995 and an old character of yours, Dolly Rawlins. This brings you right back to your early days as a writer, in fact, doesn't it?
Yes, the first series I ever wrote, you know. It was wonderful, and for Widows to have such an incredible new outing in the Steve McQueen movie, it really, for me, was wonderful, because my publisher said, what about reissuing Widows books? So there was Widows, then Widows Revenge, and She's Out, and they've been phenomenally successful for me, because they've introduced a whole new readership. And it's been translated into 36 languages, which is terrific.
And revisiting that character, I mean, when the books were reissued, you had to kind of find a space where you could bring Dolly back into fictional life in this new book. But did you revisit the books, look back at Dolly, and just look at what you'd achieved back in the 1980s?
Oh, yes, Sean, I most certainly did. Truthfully, I had somehow no real conception of what I'd done, and it really came home when I watched the DVDs of She's Out, and I looked at Anne Mitchell's performance, and it's quite astonishing. She is the most consummate, powerful actress that I don't think ever got as much kudos as she should have got. But it was, I had to polish them up, because they'd been written quite quickly. And it was just, for me, a very, very exciting period of my life, because I felt rejuvenated in a way. And from that, to go on to write Buried. And what I didn't want is that anyone picking up Buried to read it needed to know anything about Widows, Widows Revenge, or She's Out. This was a completely new book. That the ghosts of these women do resurrect themselves is something, but to me the main protagonist, DC, you know, Jack Warr, is really the driving force of the book, and will hopefully be begin a new series too. He's a terrific character.
Yeah, and I will come to him, but will you just indulge me for a little second, because I'd love to remind you, just by listening to Anne Mitchell, in fact, in the TV series from the 1980s, and in typical fashion as Dolly Rawlins here, she's explaining the plans to the others in the room.
Right. Here it is. Routes, times, etc. And they will be carrying, wait for it, 700,000.
700?
We're going to have to shift ourselves. It's 2 weeks early. So, tonight, I want to go over every detail. Tomorrow, we all go over to the tunnel to get to know the markings, streets, etc. You've already marked it out once, haven't you?
Twice.
Right. Security van starts here, point A. I move up into my position just as it goes round into Allington Street, point B.
You do it at the same time of day we'll be driving?
Yeah, of course. Now we travel in convoy of dry cleaning wagon, security van, up to this street here. That's where you'll be parked. Here.
There we go. Anne Mitchell as Dolly Rawlins. Just listening to it, Linda LaPlante, must bring you right back.
It does. It really does. And I love those women too. They were all such wonderful actresses, you know. All of them. They were all very different. And they gave so much of themselves in it. But for me, Anne Mitchell is really a great star. And I always remember, on episode 5, when the women were going to pull the robbery, there were paintings and white paint all over the East End of London saying, "Go for it, Dolly." It was a very, very exciting time for me.
Yeah, and indeed the other two actors that we heard, I think, in that clip, Maureen O'Farrell played the character of Linda and Fiona Henley playing Shirley. I think they were probably the other two voices that we heard within the clip.
Yes.
So you bring Dolly to life again at the beginning, well, to fictional life again at the beginning of Buried. But really, we find her with a group of women that she spent time in prison with. But in the present day, we meet those women again as a criminal gang. How different was it to write a group of women in 2020, or certainly contemporary times, behaving in the fashion that they do, than it was to write for women back in 1980?
Well, for me, it was quite easy because it's, going through my own life age, really. So it wasn't difficult. To me, the most difficult part of Buried was writing something that was going to grab a reader and for them to really want to know what's going to happen to them. So that the women are really, as I said earlier, there's sort of a ghost hand with them. And then when you do get to meet one or other of the women, they are so different to the way they used to be. They've had all this time out and free. And particularly Esther, outrageous character. And that's part of what I really enjoy doing, for me as a writer, is bringing into a novel characters that I think a reader will actually love to want to know more of, to want to learn more about them. And I just, I was interviewed the last time I was in Dublin by that lovely, wonderful writer, Niamh O'Connor. And some of her novels, I've just been blown away by. They're terrific. And I was there for the Murder One Crime Festival. And I had such a great time there. I love Dublin. Oh, do I love. You know what I really love about Dublin? The Guinness bread, that black bread with a slice of smoked ham on it. Oh, gosh. My mouth is watering.
Well, of course, we're all becoming experts at baking bread now that we're locked indoors. Everybody's a baker all
I
of
know.
A sudden. But you had a birthday, actually, quite recently, Linda. Did you get to celebrate it, or are you under lock and key like everybody else at the moment?
I'm under lock and key. Truthfully, Sean, I don't mind it that much because I'm used to isolation, because I go into complete isolation when I'm writing, and I hate to be disturbed. So I'm very used to being alone. However, this time it's a bit more difficult because I have a 16-year-old son. And, he went through all the emotional trauma of working very hard towards his GCSEs and then nothing. But he's been working on Skype with tutors. But it's I think, a terribly difficult time for young people all over, everywhere. Because, they've worked so hard towards the A-level exams, and they've worked towards even accomplishing a place in university if they get A results in their A-levels. And then it's all just in kind of limbo. And it must be exceedingly difficult for them to really truthfully find this solitariness. Well, I know with my son, he's done one incredible thing, actually. He has a 3D printer, and he started making specialized safety masks, not the masks that go beneath the plastic cover, but he's making the plastic cover for full face protection on his 3D computer.
Wow, that is extraordinary. I'm presuming then that you don't mind this time in isolation, as you say, Linda. You must really have enjoyed being in isolation with your fictional character, DC Jack War, who, as you said, is the protagonist in this new novel. But boy, what a task you've put in front of any man who reads about him. He's handsome. He's got a naturally athletic build. He can wear anything such as his build, and he still looks great in it. And he's just moved to London with his partner, Maggie, who he just agreed to go with her, despite what it might or might not do for his own career. When Maggie asked him, "What do you want?" his only answer was, You! What a perfect man!
I know, but the imperfection in him is that he is lacking in any form of ambition. He is really quite an inept police officer. So that although he has all these physical, you know, he great looking and he's very attractive and everybody likes him and he's good humoured, there's a major hole in his life. And when the discovery in the book and the opening of the book of horrendous murder in an old cottage that has been absolutely burnt to the ground, and the discovery of, you know, thousands and thousands of charred banknotes, £10 notes, £5 notes. And it's his, for the first time in his life, he has a flicker of ambition to uncover what went on in that cottage, which then leads him very gradually back to, did the woman in the book She's Out actually do that train robbery? And so there's a lot of humour in the book. But for me, to create a character like Jack is quite difficult, because you don't want somebody that has got everything that every other man would want, but he doesn't. He's fatally flawed. And I particularly didn't want to create a detective that either had an alcohol problem, drug problem, marital problems. He doesn't really seem to have any problems until the darkness and the discovery of who he is begins to dawn. And so I just hope it really, really the reader will enjoy reading it and liking him, because that's terribly important to me. He is a new character I've created, and I really want a reader to want more of him, which to me will then prove that I pulled it off.
The other thing about Jack is we know that he's adoptive, because we meet his adoptive parents during the novel as well. And it brings up this whole question around nature versus nurture. He ends up having moral dilemmas around certain aspects of the dealings that he's having with this criminal gang. Was nature versus nurture an important theme for you, or topic for you to explore in the case of Jack?
In a way, yes. I mean, more so because of my own son, really. To actually see if there is any truth in this nature, nurture. Because, truthfully, I just don't understand it in many, many ways, because my son is so computer literate. I am the most inept person. You know, I get into a state of total panic. And, you know, the other day I was calling for him saying, what's the Dropbox? I've lost the Dropbox. Where's the Dropbox? And he comes in and he's very cool and calm and he goes, Mother, the Dropbox is that little icon to the right. You click on that. So at the same time, his mother is this writer, crime writer. He has no interest whatsoever. I've never seen him pick up a book of mine. He's up in his rooms on his computer making these masks. And I don't understand the nature and the nurture. And maybe I tried to test it further and further in the book. Because I have this 16-year-old teenager who is a wonderful, wonderful boy in my life and has, for my life, changed my life. But at the same time, I will know there will come a time in his life where he will want to know more about where he came from.
Yeah, is it okay for me to point out that your son Lorcan, you're not his birth mother?
Yeah.
So that dealt and led directly into exploring that aspect within Jack's character. Are you often that close personally to the characters?
Yes, you'd be amazed that I get very, very close, because you live with them for so long. You know, for 18 months, I've lived with Jack Waugh and his girlfriend Maggie, just as I lived with the widows, just as I live with Prime Suspect. You live with these people, you talk to them. And to get a script or a novel ready for publication It takes a very long time of dusting and polishing and reworking and editing it down until you let it go. And the moment you let it go to your publisher is the moment you have really no control over it then. It's gone. And you will have editors. I have an editor that used a phrase to me that I'd never heard before, which was called, he said, it's judicial pruning. And it was like a red rag to a bull to me. What do you mean, judicial pruning? And they come up with these odd quotes, these editors. So you know when you let it go, the first time it's gone to be read, that's it. It's out of your hands then. And I'm with a very young publishing company, Bonnier, and their enthusiasm for the book and their enthusiasm for my work is really invigorating for me. It makes it all very positive for me to work. And particularly at this tragic time right now that everybody's in, to still have, because they're all going through it. The publishing company has had to fold, you know, they've all gone home for, you know, they're all in isolation. Everybody I work with here in my offices are in isolation. But at the same time, you know, we're used to Skyping and we're used to constantly emailing. And it's a very strange new opportunity for everyone, because we all have to reach out to other people. We all have to just check on somebody you may not have seen for a while. And at the same time, you know, look after the elderly people around you. Never mind that you're classed as elderly yourself. But, you know, and somebody said to me, oh, you could shop it an hour earlier than anybody else. But you know what I mean? This is a very strange time we're in, and a very moving time, I think.
Going back to Jack in the book, Jack Waugh, and his team, because we get to know his team as the book progresses. And I wondered about the patriarchal system that Jane Tennyson experienced in Prime Suspect. It's something you explored to in great detail throughout the life of her fictional life in the books. Is there a different dynamic now for Jack and his team? Is it less of an issue? Is it a different issue?
You can see it underline slightly. There is less discrimination now in the Metropolitan Police, but it's still there. And it's very strange for me to be as a writer. So I'm writing one very modern detective in Jack Waugh. And at the same time, I'm also working on bringing Jane Tennyson through the years before she became a detective chief inspector. So I've been going from the 70s through to the 80s. And I'm still in the 80s where Jane Tennyson is. So on one hand, I'm writing where there's no DNA, no mobile phones, and tremendous discrimination. And then on the other hand, I'm looking at how it is and how it has changed, because Jack Waugh and his team are right in the present day. And I still find little echoes and little seeds of discrimination, but they're nowhere near as they were in the beginning of Prime Suspect.
I did find it interesting, though. Obviously, you mentioned that there's a fire at the beginning of this book, and obviously we have a fire investigating officer involved there, a woman, Sally Bowne, who's doing the investigating in this case. And you point out in the book, she's a very attractive woman, and all of the people working with her are more than aware of that. She handles that attraction and the expressions of that attraction in a very interesting way that I'm not sure if it could have happened previous to 2020.
You're right, absolutely right. It wouldn't have happened. She would have been stepped over and pushed aside. But now they're fighting back. And if you think about, you know, our commissioner is a woman, Cressida Dix, and her assistant associate commander is also female. So, you know, they've broken through the glass ceilings, but at the same time, when I've been giving talks or presenting something or other for the Met police women, they come to me and they give me titbits and they give me stories. Some of it is still going on. And I'm always amazed that it has so many successful women in the Met that have had it very, very tough throughout their careers. But to just watch these women up at the top of the cream of their job, and they are quite remarkable and very impressive to me.
The ending of Buried, the latest book, Linda LaPlante, certainly suggests that there's more to come from DC Jack War. Are you already in your splendid isolation at the moment involved in such writing? Do you know where he's heading?
Yes. Yeah, I'm well away. Yeah. Yes, well away. Yeah. Well spotted, sir.
And do you expect him to make it to the television screens?
I'm very, very confident that it will, yes. And the search will be on for me to find him, because I don't want a well-known actor. I don't want an actor that's been in every single crime drama on the TV. I want to find someone new. And that's very exciting, because also, you know, at the moment, we do have tremendous scientific sections in the police. And I've just done a podcast, and to be able in a way to repay all the scientists that I work with, for me to be just asking them questions about their work, because they have been behind me at every single level and every single book and production I've ever done. And I think for every writer, the podcast should be very, very informative. Because there is, you know, as you brought up the fire, the horrendous fire in Buried, to get people to actually come in and talk to me about that and how they deal with the horror of the murder victim in it. But sometimes you're with experts and they will flick you something, a line that you wouldn't necessarily even think of. And one of the firefighters I was talking to, he said, "Oh, you're a bit wrong with your windows. They've got to blow out first. The ground floor will blow out with the heat." It's just something simple. And then, you know, they go on how they would remove the charred remains and the information they all give me. And so I have made this podcast interviewing forensic, blood splattering experts, SOCO experts, and it's, I hope, very informative for other crime writers to have a listen to.
Well, listen, it's been great to speak with you this evening, Linda, and hope you manage with the isolation over the next while. Belated happy birthday to you. That's Linda LaPlante speaking to me about her latest novel, Buried, which is published by Zafra. Empress Of is the musical moniker of Los Angeles-based singer-songwriter and record producer Lorelei Rodriguez. We'll be reviewing her new album, I'm Your Empress Of, this Friday, along with two more of the best in this week's releases. In the meantime, here's the current single from that album, Give Me Another Chance. Stranger Than Kindness is a collection of rarely seen photos and sketches that trace songwriter Nick Cave's transformation from Aussie teenager into international artist. Nadine O'Regan has been reading and looking at the book, I probably think it's safer to say, and she joins me now on the line. It's not exactly an autobiography, this one, Nadine, billed as a journey into Nick Cave's creative world. Do we get a good insight into that world?
We do get a good insight, but it's fair to say it is very much not an autobiography. In fact, to some extent, Nick Cave seems barely present even in the pages, even though, of course, this is all of his memorabilia that we're seeing across the course of just under 300 pages. So you're looking at everything from icons of Christ that he was enamored with, to tote bags that he collected from Kylie Minogue and took on his travels, to scraps of lyrics, to notebooks. But actually, he does very, very little commentary. There's a bit of commentary at the back of the book where we get a bit of an insight into his thought process, particularly between past and present. But actually, this is very much about Nick Cave rather than by Nick Cave, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, so I think one of the earliest pictures we get in the book is a picture of his father and a picture of Nick Cave beside him when he's a very young boy, 8 or 9 years old, which he has referred to as his most intimate moment with his father. Does it follow a chronological path, or is it more scattergun than that?
Yeah, there's a chronological path followed, and there's a beautiful picture actually of his mother there as well. And both of his parents seem to be very inspirational to him. His mum was very insistent that he should have art classes when he was growing up in Victoria in Australia, and his father actually passed away in an accident when Nick Cave was just 21. And Nick Cave says at the back of the book that was an experience that obviously losing him at such a young age was very difficult, but it was also at a point in his life when he was a confused young man. And actually there are school reports in the book that in true post-punk or punk rock fashion reveal to us that Nick Cave got in trouble from a young age. As a teenager, his headmaster got in touch from Caulfield Grammar School to say that Nick has a lack of respect for authority, and indeed that would prove to be true throughout his career to date.
Yeah, there's a picture that I noticed again in one of, I think it was in The Guardian, I saw it on their website, of a group of him, Nick Cave, and his school pals. I think this might have been at a different school, sitting, most of them looking at the camera, but of course Nick Cave was not looking at the camera. The teenager wouldn't have been that gauche and that up front, really, would he?
No, and the thing about Nick Cave is he's as much a visual artist as he is a musical one, and I should say, by the way, that like he is a phenomenal musical artist. I mean, I first saw him when I was a teenager, and he has never been less than brilliant on the stage. He's just so impressive. But in the early lists, he's a big list maker, and one of the things that I thought was quite interesting was when he was making a list, I think when he was back with the Birthday Party in Australia before he moved to London in 1980, he was talking about the things he wasn't happy with. And he said specifically that he was not happy with the band's visual performance, and he was also not happy with, and I quote, 50% of our material.
And in fact, the visuals do play a big part in this, because yes, there are photographs, but there are sketches and paintings of his own. How good an artist is he?
Interesting. I mean, I think, as he says himself at the start of the book, like he wants you not to read or to look at these pieces as artwork so much as what he says are the wild-eyed and compulsive superstructure that bears the song or book or script or score along. They are a support system of manic tangential information. And I think if you have the book in that context, and if you're a Nick Cave fan, it actually is quite fascinating, because you see things like the lyrics for Deanna or Red Right Hand, and then you see across from that a little figurine of Christ, which actually was given to him by Victoria Mary Clark for his 40th birthday, and which he keeps on his mantelpiece by his bed as a kind of a talisman, as a protective figure. And Nick Cave as a person, you know, he's so interesting to think about in the context of religion, because he never really dismisses religion, for all that, you know, he's a punk rock figure in essence going back in the day. But he says that, you know, he tries to maintain a curiosity, and he says about God that, you know, I've been circling around the idea of God for decades. And he says, I think we get what we are willing to believe, and that our experience of the world extends to the limits of our interests, which is actually a really thought-provoking way to put it. And certainly the book and all the iconography littered throughout the book really bears testament to that.
Yeah, and in fact, the novelist Darcy Stanke, if that's how I say her name, if I'm saying that correctly, she gives us this treatise on Cave's life. This is the major bit of text, I suppose, within the book itself. And she directly refers to that religion and faith aspect within Nick Cave's life, and specifically gives us some ideas around the song Into My Arms. Just before we listen to it, give us a sense of some of the things she says about that song and what it tells us about Nick Cave.
Well, she's very interested, I suppose, in comparing Nick Cave to other great writers, William Faulkner, the 18th century poet John Keats also. And she believes that Nick Cave belongs to, I suppose, the finest category of writers, because she believes that he can inhabit a zone of what she calls mystery, or what John Keats called paradox or negative capability, when somebody is capable of existing in uncertainties. And I think the opening lines of Into My Arms, you know, are so so wonderfully paradoxical in how they play out to the listener. You know, I don't believe in an interventionist God, but darling, if I did, you know, and he goes on from there. And it's just one of those songs that for me, I think it probably is my favorite Nick Cave song, but every time I hear it, I'm struck again by the longing to believe in a way that comes from that song and the warmth and the desire in it.
Well, here you go. Have a listen and be struck again.
Into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms, oh Lord, into my arms.
Into my arms, from Nick Cave, and Nadine O'Regan is with us this evening talking about a new book that Cave has published, Stranger Than Kindness. Effectively a type of set of memory. It's almost a scrapbook feel to it, which seems to be something that is becoming quite prevalent in recent times. Debbie Harry's autobiography in recent times contained a lot of fan art and personal pictures. Seems to be a way of maybe an artist talking about themselves without having to use direct words, which they all hate doing, of course, Nadine.
Yeah, there's that aspect to it. And then there's the very, I'm going to say, cynical aspect to it, which is that, you know, artists these days are selling fewer records. So a lot of them have turned to the books industry to appeal to their niche. So companies like Canongate, which publishes this book, or Faber, which has published the recent Bob Geldof book, they are playing into maybe a smaller kind of coterie of an audience, but one that is nonetheless absolutely passionate. I mean, if you think about the average Nick Cave fan, somebody who likes Nick Cave tends to really, really like Nick Cave, you know, so they will want the book. And actually, for the Nick Cave fan, there really is a lot here. For the casual fan, I would say they'll just skip over this without a second glance. But for me, like, certainly reading a lot of the lyrics and seeing them written in his hand with little annotations or hesitations on the actual scrawl, it's kind of provocative as a reading experience, because you start thinking about different lines that might have been there, or different changes that could have been made.
Into My Arms, that we just listened to the opening section of there, written for his wife, Susie Bick, if I'm right. Does his family, you know, you mentioned that his mother and father are there, and his childhood years are mentioned. Do we get much about his family life right now? In particular, I suppose I'm thinking of the terrible tragedy in 2015, the death of his teenage son, Arthur.
Yeah, you know, it's so sad what happened. The couple had twin boys, and at the age of 15, Arthur fell to his death off a cliff near their home. And he had been experimenting with hallucinogenics, first time trying them, and had gotten very disorientated. And that terrible fact was made very, very public. And Nick Cave and his wife, Susie, had to go through the experience publicly, which must have been very, very difficult for them. And actually, I think one of the reasons that there isn't very much about his family in this book is partly as an attempt to maintain some element of privacy around the past 5 years and what it's been like for them as a family. I know there have been films and documentaries made which gesture to that subject or focus on that subject, but Nick Cave has been hesitant about ever releasing anything, because he has said that he's just concerned about the idea of what he calls grief porn. But at the same time, his recent albums with the Bad Seeds, you know, albums like Ghosteen, they really, even though the lyrics are quite abstract, it's so obvious that grief just percolates through those records. You know, there's a very still, meditative air from the music, and it's very desolate sounding, while also very beautiful.
And in fact, you mentioned grief porn there, wasn't it? Into My Arms, he sung at the funeral of Michael Hutchins, and he said, and it was all televised, of course, and he said, yes, you can televise this, but not while I'm singing that song. I don't want cameras rolling.
Yeah, and actually, funnily enough, my first encounter with him as an artist was shortly after that period, and he had come to Skibbereen in West Cork to stay. He used to stay in West Cork quite a lot, and he would hang out in the area, and he was still clearly very, very just traumatized by the whole experience. And bear in mind as well, and the book does make some mention of this, Nick Cave had gone through an extensive drug period himself. You know, he had experimented not just experimented, but really had a very difficult time at certain points in his career. So Michael Hutchence's circumstance, coupled with his own circumstances, there was a point in the late 90s when things were pretty rough.
Yeah, was there anything within the material in this current book then, Stranger Than Kindness, that illuminated that period in Nick Cave's life in any way for you?
I think to some extent absence is illuminating, because, you know, I think sometimes you have to wait several years to really write about a thing, and it may take you that long to make sense of it. And I think that the absence in this book suggests to me that he isn't quite ready to deliver in a really straight way exactly on the page how he's feeling. And I think you have to respect that. You know, there's a great sense of love actually in the book for his wife Susie, who's very well known actually to a lot of people who love beautiful dresses. She's got a company called The Vampire's Wife, and they make very expensive and very beautiful dresses for a lot of celebrities. But you know, it is a grab bag in a sense, because, you know, he's not really making an attempt to provide structure other than that. These are the points of inspiration for him. And actually there is a bit of a comic moment as well when we see a little picture of a Kylie Minogue tote bag, a blue and pink tote bag, and he talks about how they have been unlikely collaborators. They have the Where the Wild Roses Grow, that's a beautiful song together. But apparently he found the bag at one time and he asked the guy who owned it, he said, look, can I take this bag? There was just something about it. And he actually brought the bag on tour with him for absolutely years. And I think it just suggests to people, and I think this is key to where he's coming from, he's sort of saying, look, don't write me off as a one-dimensional goth-like post-punk figure. I am able to inhabit other realms, and I'll take that tote bag if I want to. So there is comedy there too.
Yeah, and I mean, another part that I found quite funny, I'm not sure what particular period in his life these come from, I'm guessing maybe teen years, his dictionary of words, which he then presumably uses at different points to put into his writings, because he's written not just lyrics and songs, obviously, but there are plays in there are screenplays, there are a couple of novels as well. When does that, do you remember what particular period that dictionary comes from, or do you remember it?
Oh, the homemade dictionary. Yeah, there's a lovely, yeah. It's quite enticing, isn't it? Because you look at the dictionary and you think, hang on a minute, I want to see what's in the dictionary. I don't just want to picture the front cover. But actually, I was interested to read that all of these pieces are going to be in an exhibition in Copenhagen later this year. And I wonder if you might be able to open the dictionary at that point and actually see what's in there. Because certainly it was one of the most kind of intriguing photographs in the book for me.
Certainly tease me. Who knows if that will go ahead, that exhibition in Copenhagen, because obviously his shows next month in the Three Arena have been postponed. No news as of yet as to when or how they will be rescheduled. But just, we will finish up with Nick and Kylie and the tote bag in a minute, Nadine. But who is this, really a book for the fans? Who is it for, do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a book for the fans. As I was mentioning, it's published by Canongate, they've got a great reputation for fiction, but certainly in nonfiction, they would maybe go towards more the niche category. And I think this is a great example of a book that really strongly appeals to a very specific type of person, and maybe will not register at all on the consciousness of people who are not extreme fans.
Well, for the extreme fans then, Stranger Than Kindness is the name of the book that Nadine O'Regan has been talking to us about, by Nick Cave. It's published, as Nadine told us, by Canongate. And let's finish up then with Nick Cave and Kylie Minogue, Where the Wild Roses Grow. A Galway-based writer Alan McMonagall won much praise for his first novel, Ithaca, which was told from the point of view of a young boy called Jason. His latest novel, Laura Cassidy's Walk of Fame, is narrated by the title character, a young woman on the verge of adulthood, or possibly a little bit into her early adulthood, but intent on pursuing a life in acting and looking for a start in Galway's vibrant theatre scene. And Alan McMonagall joins me now on the line. It is a fictional version of Galway's vibrant theatre scene that we're getting here. But how familiar are you with that world, Alan? The auditions, the highs, the lows and all the rest of it?
Hello, Sean. Thanks for having me. Well, yeah, I've lived in Galway for a long time. So I've gotten to know, you know, the scene to a certain extent, met some colourful characters. And Galway's always been a big theatre town. And so, you know, it's going to come with its highs and lows and ups and downs and interesting moments. But as you said, it's very much a fictional rendering of the scene.
Although I'm pretty sure that people within the scene have already said, asked you about various characters and equating them with real life possible models. But I'm sure you will tell me everything is purely fictional. Any resemblance to real life is purely coincidental.
Yeah, that's the line I've been taking since since Ithaca, actually. Set very much in a fictitious Midlands town. So this is very much a fictitious version of small west of Ireland based coastal city. Yeah.
Well, tell me a little bit about the title character then here, Alan, Laura Cassidy. Her love of acting comes from her father, and in particular a love of films of Hollywood's golden era, the 30s and 40s.
Yeah, that's right. So, the title character, Laura Cassidy, she's quite, mid-20s perhaps when we first meet her. And she's a young woman, a budding actress with a dream to become a star. And this is an ambition, a dream that was planted inside her by her theatre-obsessed, movie-loving father when she was a young girl. And it's, you know, this is seared into her fabric, into her core. And she, to the extent that she's convinced that, you know, it is her destiny, London, the West End, New York, Broadway, Tinseltown, Hollywood, movie stardom, Oscar glory, the whole bit, you know, to the extent that she will have her name eventually etched in a star on this so-called Hollywood Walk of Fame. And she is convinced that she's going all the way.
And I suppose no harm in having such lofty ambition and such high ideals, but how delusional do you think she is?
Well, I think that is one of the words I would use. I think it's possibly best described as a comedy of aspirations pitted against unusual levels of blind optimism. And obviously this blind optimism comes with a hefty dollop of delusion. Delusion, aspiration, increasing levels of desperation quickly become order of the day. But as I say, she is steadfast in her belief and certainty that, you know, she is going all the way. And so she's going to pursue this dream.
There are five, I suppose the book is divided into five major parts with about 9 or 10 chapters in each part. And at the beginning of each of those parts, you give us the short biog of a number of Hollywood stars, Barbara Stanwyck, Veronica Lake, Lana Turner, Jean Tierney, Gloria Swanson. It seems to me that those might be great heroes, possibly of Alan McMonagall as well. Am I right?
you could be right and correct there, Sean, as my grandfather used to say. I mean, it's probably one of my abiding memories anyway, when I was so high or knee high, being planted in front of the television screen in our end of row house. It would have been a Saturday night, the TV tuned to the BBC. It would have been a season of golden oldies, probably started off with the gangster films from the 1930s, like James Cagney, Humphrey Bogart and so forth, but quickly moved on to these so-called film noirs and these fast-talking, tough guys and women who were able to give them very much as good as they got. And yeah, the early discoveries for me were the names you've just mentioned, Lana Turner, Veronica Lake, Gloria Swanson, Lauren Bacall, and of course Barbara Stanwyck.
Would we listen to a little clip of Barbara Stanwyck, actually, just to remind us of how fast talking she could be? This is a clip from Double Indemnity.
Mr. Neff, why don't you drop by tomorrow evening around 8:30? He'll be in then.
Who?
My husband. You were anxious to talk to him, weren't you?
Yeah, I was, but I'm sort of getting over the idea, if you know what I mean.
There's a speed limit in this state, Mr. Neff. 45 miles an hour.
How fast was I going, officer?
I'd say around 90.
Suppose you get down off your motorcycle and give me a ticket.
Suppose I let you off with a warning this time.
Suppose it doesn't take.
Suppose I have to whack you over the knuckles.
Suppose I bust out crying and put my head on your shoulder.
Suppose you try putting it on my husband's shoulder.
That tears it. Eight 8:30 tomorrow evening, then.
That's what I suggested.
Will you be here, too?
I guess so. I usually am.
Same chair, same perfume, same anklet.
I wonder if I know what you mean.
I wonder if you wonder. It was a hot afternoon, and I can still remember the smell of honeysuckle all along that street. How could I have known that murder can sometimes smell like honeysuckle? Maybe you would have known, Keyes, the minute she mentioned accident insurance. But I didn't. I felt like a million.
Fred McMurray there and Barbara Stanwyck in a little clip from Double Indemnity. And Barbara Stanwyck, I play that Alan McMonagall because she features in one of those biogs in your novel, The Walk of Laura Cassidy's Walk of Fame. Now, for all the Hollywood stuff and all the aspirational comedy that you speak about, there's grief in there as well, just bubbling away underneath the surface. I think we realise fairly early on that all is not well with Laura.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, she has a very fragile psyche. How much she is aware of this is, you know, for us to decide, the reader, and indeed myself as the author. She's had quite a crucial setback quite early on in her life. Her father, who she clearly adores and is very much influenced by, he dies tragically in a horrific accident, stormy night on the pier at the Galway Harbour. And of course, crucially, Laura has witnessed this, and it's quite a key moment in her life because she herself has just bagged the lead role in the school play, and she is so thrilled and delighted that she hurries out to share the good news with her dad, knowing where he is. And so she witnesses this terrible accident. And really, in a way, from that moment on, you could say that she becomes stuck, paralyzed even. And it sort of evinces itself as a combination of trauma, grief, and fear. And later on, when she does manage to bag a role, it's one of the flashback scenes, she puts it down to stage fright herself, but there is probably a lot more, as you say, going on beneath the surface. Her father and his tragic early death, it looms quite large in Laura's story.
All right. Well, that's gives us a taste of the novel indeed. And congratulations to you on that second novel. Alan McMonagall there talking to us about his latest novel, Laura Cassidy's Walk of Fame, which is published by Picador. And that is our lot for this evening. Leah Murphy and Paula Shields research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Jimmy Doyle was on sound. And this evening's programme was produced by Kay Sheehy. Talk to you tomorrow night once again at 7 o'clock. Look after yourselves. Look after each other.